Frontiersman, Dial-Up Internet is proud to present the Tommy Knutson Dial-Up Streaming Special.
What a crowd. Holy cow, I've never seen so much flannel in my life. Hey, you're going to church or ice fishing in that outfit? Speaking of ice fishing, I tried it once. Man, was it cold. You know how to communicate with a bluegill when you're ice fishing? Huh? You drop in a line. Crazy, you know? I haven't been allowed within 100 yards of a playground for years. Why can't dinosaurs play basketball? Because they're dead. Huh? Get it? They're freaking dead.
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 podcast. Jay Bird, how are the Ides of February?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad at all. Nice day out here today. Yeah, it broke freezing.
Yeah. What do you know? We went from 20 to 65.
So 65? Oh, nice.
Just absolutely scary jumps there. I actually had a catch up day. I've been so busy. Obviously, last week I had to hit the road unexpectedly for BizNAS, and then I was doing BizNAS all day long. But it has just been the season of, not the season, but kind of like the last week and a half, just massive fluctuation. Just got poured on, dumped on, right? Everything's horrible. Mm-hmm. Then I have one of my best numbers days I've ever had. And then it's like just up and down, man. It's such a crazy, just a roller coaster ride. Hold on, kids. Buckle up tight.
Right.
We're going on the wee ride.
You might get hurt.
Yeah. You might get the slime. But yeah, it's been crazy. Been putting some pigs in the boat there, but you know, that's going on. I can't believe it, believe it or not. Can you believe it, believe it or not? Believe.
No, not exactly.
Not exactly. But we're almost there. I mean, it's February 9th.
I know.
You've made it past the halfway mark, I believe. I don't know. I've heard of such, like, the solstice.
Winter's going fast. I think it's going, it's blowing by. We're basically, like you said, it's basically, spring is right around the corner. Melting is right around the corner.
Yeah.
We're saying 40s here for the weekend. So for us, it's way above normal and not good for snowmobiling, but great for everything else. Man, ice fishing around here has been great. Yeah, conditions are excellent. Yeah, you can drive anywhere you want pretty much and not worried about getting stuck and all that. So
good stuff. But yeah, if you're in the northern zone, you're rounding the corner. I talked to the Danny of the Herbex earlier.
Did you?
He was out riding his snowmobile and said it had warmed up a little bit. It's been so frigid up there. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. At least I'm looking at my forecast where it looks spooky warm. But we'll see here shortly. But you keep your chin up, big dog. It's almost over with. You guys up north will be swinging the bat here before too long. And, you know, the fun thing.
Yep.
And, you know, I got an email about it. We'll talk for a second because we're going to have Dr. Bob. I'm going to call the Dr. Bob here shortly. All right. Mm-hmm. But Jay sent me another. It looks like the spearing is off the chain this year. It's just.
Friend sent me a picture of there was a spearing tournament over the weekend.
Ooh, do tell.
Close to the Muskie shop. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, they got a 49 3/4. Oh, okay.
Did it swim away?
No.
Oh.
No.
I got a bunch. I was looking at the emails for the podcast, and I was like, oh, God. It was just like, there was like six of them in there. Somebody wanted to address it, and here's the thing. And this is just a truism of it. Can't do anything about it. Right? Because one guy, and it was a perfectly fine email the guy sent over. But it's kind of the summarization of it was it feels silly doing CPR and this happens, right? And I would say, Jay, you've been around. I think the impact of the native spearing is getting less and less as time goes on, right? I know it's prevalent. Don't scream at me. But in years past, I'm talking like decades past, there was a heck of a lot more people spearing them, right? That's one of those things. I mean, there's nothing that we can do other than, I think the best thing that one can do is bite your tongue and don't engage. And I'll tell you, and I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but I'll tell you. Jay knows this story. I don't know if I've talked about it at all, but it doesn't matter. I was in Wisconsin, and I was having a delicious beverage, and I was solo. And a couple natives were there, and that's fine. I married that kind of type myself, so it you know, we're all cool. They started in on the musky stuff, right? Oh, and they were bragging about it, 'cause I'm sitting there wearing the hat and wearing my musky shop hat. I've got my musky shop hoodie. And they thought it would be funny to try to get me going on that. And I'll tell you, the best way to do it is just, I went, that's awesome, man. It's cultural. How cool. Do you guys have a good season doing it? And you ought to see the what? That's not the response they get, right? They're waiting for me to say something. And then we're rolling around in the floor of the old pig in a poke in Wisconsin, right? I would recommend, for what it's worth, because I think there's goading that goes on with that, just stay out of it. You know, the madder you get on the internet, the more they want to get you mad on the internet. And just leave it be. You know, don't lose any sleep over it. I don't think yes, it can damage fisheries. Don't get me wrong. But the overall impact, as negative as it is, you know, I think the best managerial thing to do is just not give in to that. Don't give in to that knee-jerk reaction, you know. And then write your congressman. That's more productive than fighting on the internet. You know, write I don't know who you would write. The Board of Indian Affairs, maybe. I don't know. You know, you have the internet. Look it up. But I just wanted to bring that up because there were some heated emails asking what to do. Not what to do or what could be done, if you will. And that's what can be done. The best thing you can do is don't engage. And if it's something that's done, because I've actually received them at the app where it's like, oh, we had a great day on the water, and it's that, right? We've gotten those messages at the app and the email.
Okay.
And just move on. After a while, you just move on. You can't do anything about it. It's like one of my favorite Simpsons joke: old man screams at sky, Jay. Right? Or old man screams at a cloud. You can't do anything about it. But if you don't interact, it probably over time would decrease the flaunting, at least, you know, so that would be.
Yeah, you know, right. You egg on the wrong people and they're going to just try to make it worse and they're going to go out of their way to do more damage because they get off on that.
So we're not judging. Maybe some do. No, some don't.
I've seen it happen. You know? Same thing. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things in Muskie. That's the law. They can do that. They were within their rights to do that. So, like you said, that's probably not going to change anytime soon. God, it hasn't changed for hundreds of years.
I'm laughing. I just opened up and I'm saying this. Who is it? This guy. It's a screenshot from like a LaBarge Outdoors sent it to me, right? So yeah, this is prevalent this week. That's making the rounds. But yeah, just let it, you know, the more you let it roll off, I think with things like this, the joke's on you. If you get mad about it, the joke's on you. That's it. You know, don't engage. Best thing you can do. Other than that, got some cool new things with the comings and the goings at the Muskie Shop. What does it look like? You got the rough dog
or rough tackle? Yeah, the rough tackle stuff. Yeah, rough tackle. They make the rad dogs. They
How can one be rough? Series, so, I mean, it's admirable. Imagine it, simultaneously you're being rough and rad.
No,
it's that's rough, a high
rough,
bar.
Rough. Steve, well, get it? Rad dog. Yes, I get it.
Forget it. You're because you're the target audience.
Yeah, they got so anyway. They got some new stuff out there. Glow blades, glow skirts.
Okay,
cool. Turn up the color, baby.
Wow, it's like a day glow Pink Floyd.
I wonder what Dr. Bob would think about something like that because he probably is not accustomed to using glow products.
With all his not on the water
science and physics with color and light
glow stuff around the house.
Oh, I see.
I don't know. What do we got?
More on that later, folks.
Buzz,
yeah.
Buzz bait. Cool. Interesting. That's neat. It's like a glow flashaboo. So, yeah, I've heard guys have pretty good success on glow in the dark baits. My, like a lot of the fisheries I fish on, I haven't had any luck. However, there's a couple guys that I know that swear by like, bucktails at night that have a little bit of glow to them. Like if you're moving really slow, and there's obviously some of those tannic fishery. That'd be interesting to see what a glow bait would do in a tannic fishery.
That's what I was thinking, more so than night fishing. Because, I mean, I experimented with that way back when, you know, using glow stuff at night. And always did better on black stuff. This is more bass fishing, though, actually, back in the 90s. But with that, but yeah, I mean.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
Now I see. I think that'd be a neat application because the, you know, the kind of the Northwood special there with that purple, like the grape
Northwood
flame.
Special purple.
Okay. Yeah, special purple.
Oh, okay.
But the kind of the Northwoods grape flame, that trend that a lot of guys have caught on to on some of that darker water. If you look at that purple in the water, it kind of has a, I don't know how to articulate, like a sheen or a, I don't want to say a glow, but it's got, it just
like a halo,
like a haloing effect.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking intention wise for this. I think that would be really worth experimenting with something like that in the dark waters and the tannic waters. Yeah. I think it could be cool.
Paint the entire bottom of your boat glow.
Imagine that, Steve.
Party's on top side and bottom
those
side.
Little lasers going and stuff. Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry. Before we let the beat drop, let me just go ahead and get Dr. Bob going. Hold on.
Let's get that Dr. Bob going.
We got him on the line, folks. Dr. Bob.
He's the one that called Dr. Bob good.
What do you think? I'm working on it. It's a work in progress. That might be he's the one.
I just, sounds good.
You know,
Dr. Bob in the house. There he is. I can hear him now.
I'm sorry. We forget the podcast. I'm writing lyrics in my head right now to Dr. Feel Good for Dr. Bob. Rat tail Jimmy. He's sorry. Well, what?
Okay, asking Steve.
How's the wonderful weather there in the cities of Twins?
Oh, it's great today. We had almost 40, so it's unusual. We're out of the deep freeze. Better than usual.
Very nice. There's nothing wrong with that. And hold on, let me get this pulled up. Wanted to have the old Dr. Bob on. Wrote a pretty dang interesting piece here. For the app on how much, you know what, Bob? I was supposed to do something else before I called you. Let me take care of that while you're here. Jay, I literally talk about ADD theater here. But Bob can jump in on this train because he's been one of my beta testers. Before we jump into Bob's article, folks, there's a few new things happening at the app, right? So if you're driving, I recommend looking at your phone and not the road right now. This is the time. Do not do that. I take no responsibility.
You just fell wrong, Steve.
Right. Do not do that. Pull over or stop the car, whatever you got to do. Added some things to the app that I think knocked this thing from, it was super functional, super useful, kind of that next level here. So I'm just going to start and go through them. Bob the beta tester, right? Beta testing Bob's been aware of this, so he can kind of jump in a bit here. So, front page, you still got your thing. That's kind of your spitting everything at you. You got your articles, got your videos, moon. If you've not used the moon phase in a while or you haven't been on the water for a while, if you have your location permissions turned on, this is like as quick and instant and as accurate as you can get it. So, it is just a little bit of an update from the last cool version of the moon phase, right? That sucker's on there, works like a champ everywhere you go. A lot of people would ask me, they said, well, I want to look at the moon phase for, you know, Lake of the Woods or where I'm going. So we go to my 360 and you go and we have the moon by location. We've kind of touched on this before. If you want to look at the moon phase for a place that you're going, it's all there, right? Yakety schmackety, got a list of lakes here. You can enter in a lake name. You can enter in a city name. You can enter in a zip code. It'll help you find that lake, right? I put in like, white sand, it will know what lake you're looking for. So it has a database of the lakes, and it'll give you the correlating moon phase for that. And then, like here, I'm looking at Alexandria Chain there in Minnesota. Just like on the other moon phase section of the app, I can look forward and back all over the place. So you can research your catches, because a big thing about constant muskie success is note keeping, right? So you can even look back. I'm plowing through them here, folks, because there's a ton. One of the funkiest things here, Bob, some people said he couldn't do it. Do you know that? They were like, he can't. There's no way.
Not me.
I can't believe that he's selling you short at this point.
Right?
Can't be true.
Can't be true. Say it ain't so, Bob. Say it ain't so.
It ain't so.
So, spots and trails. Check this out. This is not for navigation. I'm going to say that. There's a thing at the bottom. Reference only. This is a mapping feature in the app. So, if you want to mark a location somewhere, it is right there. My favorite thing at the top, you have a road view, and then you have a satellite view. First thing I love this for, you're trying to find a boat ramp on a lake to mark, right? You can't see it from the tree cover, but you can see it on the roads. You can toggle back and forth, mark a boat ramp, wherever you want to find, things of that nature, right? On the water marking, whatever you want to mark, however you want to use it, it is there. So, my favorite thing, though, is there's a little button down here that I worked forever on. It says export GPX. Bob, will you tell everybody what a GPX file is?
Well, GPX file is a specific format where it can, that is pretty universal, that basically saves the GPS coordinates of either a trajectory, which is trails, or a particular point, which would be like the spot, like a waypoint or something like that. So yeah, it's extremely precise, and it's a format that is used across most platforms that I know of anyway. So, right. And by cross-platform, it's Garmin, it's Lowrance, it's to an extent Humminbird, I think, can do
depend
it.
Depending on your unit. Yep.
Depending on your unit, yeah.
So, with this, and I actually was sending stuff back and forth via text with Bob. You can text a location, but the coolest thing is to export all the GPX data, and you can copy that onto an SD. There you have it.
Yeah.
So, No subscription needed. There are apps that'll cost you $20 a year or $10 a month to do that. I ain't paying for it. I said I can build a better mousetrap, boys. So, that is free inside the app. So, if you're marking something for reference, not navigation, and you want to export that GPX file, you can export that to your email. And then from your email, you can do all kinds of cool stuff. So you've got trails, you got all that stuff in there, which is, that's pretty heavy hitter in my opinion.
Yeah. And if I might add too, I'm a little bit mad about it because, the satellite imaging is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
The satellite imagery that you have is pretty good. So if you look closely at some of your lakes, like here in Minnesota when the sand bites on,
you can
see the sand from satellite. So it's like, there's no secrets anymore, but that's available to everybody. But
I know.
Very visible.
The satellite, this, you know, and a lot of this is tech, is, you know, and what's available and get our hands on here. But the satellite imaging on here is ridiculous without all the obstructions, without the 3D over, you know, you'll get on a different services. One thing I'll tell you, like, and just usury, like me using it, to find a lake. So if I have the satellite on, you're not seeing the state markers or even country markers, say, in between Minnesota. You're always kind of looking at the Great Lakes. So if I want to look at, say, Eagle, I'm kind of going up there. But if you toggle back and forth, it's so much easier. You go, oh, wow, I'm going to, you know, what am I looking at here? I'm looking at, you know, freaking Eagle. Right. And boom, I've dialed in on the street view or the maps view, and boom, hit satellite, and I'm already there. So it's super easy to find. So that was one of the features I really wanted to fool with. One thing I will just get out of the way on this front when it comes to all the features in the app, nobody ever reads terms of service, but in the terms of service, we do not keep or track any of this, period. So you don't have to worry about, well, old Steve's gonna take my spot. No, I have better things to do. So that is in the terms of service. Can't even access it. That's actually, anything that you put on there is stored on your device. That's not stored on a cloud or anything of that nature. So if you drop a waypoint or you mark a spot, that is saved in your phone, not anywhere else. But yeah, it's like I said, I was sick of all the other apps, and I said, build a better mousetrap. So, and like the, as Bob had said, the sat views are pretty dang clean. You know, you can get pretty detailed in there if you're digging around looking for stuff. So yeah, that's impactful, right? Mm-hmm. Let's keep going here. Musky weather. Another thing, every time I get on my phone and I have very little service, I'm trying to get out there. The freaking, have you noticed, guys, like the weather apps, you'll be like, is there a thunderstorm coming? And you get an ad for like freaking jungle bingo, right? You're worried about, am I going to be in a lightning storm and some geriatric clickbait, you know, it's like Sasquatch slots, play now, pops up. Sick of it. So this is pulling from, I won't bore you with the nerd of it, but there are things called APIs, and this is your legit weather to exactly where you're at. So you have kind of an outlook forecast here. You can back out of that and update it. And you do have, I wanted to make it light, meaning light load on your signal. So if you want to see a live weather radar, you can hit the live weather radar. It'll take you to rainviewer.com, right? Kind of in a browser style. But this
and
is
like, free.
Yeah, and it's free. But this is like, again, I'm a Weather Channel app kind of guy, but that sucker doesn't want to load. So this is a heck of a thing to have in your phone where you go, okay, I can load this with like one bar and I can load it fast. Oh, dude, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I want to see the weather and it's like freaking monkey slots. Play now. Yeah. And I close the whole
They're
app
just
out.
Loaded with pop-ups, right. All those channels. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this is it, and it is continually updating. This is the real deal, right? So this is your precise location. Every time you go out of that and you re-up it, it's going to reload, right? So if you're trying to watch for weather or trying to dial in on a bite, it can help you. So you have your wind speed, your wind direction, humidity, pressure, and then that hourly forecast, you know, so that'll kind of let you know there.
I tested it too by going into basically a concrete cave where I work, and because you know where I did have like literally one bar, and I said, okay, well, how long is it going to take? And it snaps right up. The like he was saying, the data requirements are so low that it pops right up. It's like you don't need much service. As long as you have any service, it seems like it works. Just golden. So yeah,
same thing with Moon. That was my whole thing, is like, this has to be usable. I have to maximize everything to be as usable in the water as possible. So
yeah.
So these are big updates, folks. I mean, the app's free. I just want to make, anytime I'm doing this, I'm always doing, my knee jerk is like, what do I need on the water? So here it is, and it's for free, and use it. But the one thing, and it's not why I have Bob on, but we've been talking about it. A new little thing, and it's on the app, Steve's Musky Power Hour. And one might say, what on earth is that? Okay. So Bob, as we all know, is agnostic about moon phase. Bob, how do you feel about moon phase?
Well, we'll call it agnostic. I think that's a good. Right, right. I'm a doubter, but
moon phase
I'm a
denier.
I'm a moon skeptic.
Denier. So, here's my thought, and you've heard me beat it to death, folks. Light penetration, the edge of light. You see it on live imaging. They only come so high at certain times and things of this nature. So Steve's Musky Power Hour is in its beta stages, folks. This is the beginning. I've been working on it for quite some time. I've had some good results with it. What this is doing is predicting for a 24-hour block, not necessarily sunrise or sunset, and not necessarily the major, right? So if we have 24 hours, you will have solar lunar events. The sun will rise and the sun will set, right? If none of those things happen, we're all dead. Okay, so those are given. What I'm looking for are those bite windows that are unexpected, that are conditionally driven. And what I believe more so than anything is not the major, it is the sun positioning, how light subtends in the water column, and if muskies feel like they can see better, can they perceive the presentation vibrationally, and do they feel comfortable and confident enough that they can close the gap without losing it from a lighting standpoint, right? That's one of the biggest drivers, is how much light penetration you have. And Bob New noticed in the app, or in this section on the Power Hour, this actually tells you the angle of the sun where you're standing. Right?
Right.
Now, do I have it 100% right? We shall see. That's why it's a beta test. But what's interesting is actually having that. So you have your light direction, which is west. You know, right now it's obviously west. But, you know, it tells me I have 0% cloud cover. But because of the sun angle, which is nighttime here, right, which is negative 22 degrees, I have low light penetration, obviously. But this is going to predict off of what's happening with your weather. That's why you have the weather on that. Now, so what your weather is at your location, what is the angle of the sun, and how will weather, sun angle, cloud cover, right, humidity, all these factors play into creating things that you might not perceive before they happen, right? So if there's a storm, or there's a condition, or there's a change, this is predicting changes at your location. It's anticipating that there will be change, right? And it's like we've talked about it forever. And Bob, I'll let you get your two cents in here about, you know, those small changes that happen on the water that spur bite windows, right?
Right.
The wind shifts. This happens. That happens. You know, when you've got 17 different apps on your phone and you're trying to follow moon phase weather, you're trying to follow this, that, and the other, it's hard to kind of look at that while you're driving the boat and going, what lure should I throw? Right.
Right.
You know, so it's and I mean, looking for, if you will, when is going to be a time where a bite window should occur or can occur. And then Bob, how did you put it when you about it's a working theory, I guess. How do you articulate?
Yeah, in my business, we call these things effective theories. We don't know exactly why it goes on, but if you can build an idea about what you think might work, this is what's called an effective theory in science. It's a theory without a theory behind it.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Fundamentals behind it necessarily.
Right.
And yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. The floor is yours.
But I thought, I mean, this is interesting to me because, I mean, as anglers get better, and I think people, in no small part due to the, you know, tons of information that's out there right now, as anglers get better, the more obvious windows are going to be exploited. And that's stuff like, you know, sunrise and sunset. That's there's no hiding that. I mean, everybody knows that sunrise and sunset's a good time. And for those that believe in the moon, they know that the moon is, you know, lunar events are going to be a good time. It's going to open windows. But what are those other subtle effects that are hard to notice, or they're coming in the future and you're not sure that that's going to materialize, but when are they going to be? Mm-hmm. What? And that's the thing. So it's that subtle sort of, again, in my business, we call that a second order effect. The first order effect is, of course, really, really important. But if everybody knows about the first order effects and the first order, you know, things that are causing bite windows to occur, it's the second order effects that become crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everybody's fishing on the first order events, eventually the muskies are going to get wise to 17 bucktails flying over their heads.
Right.
And they're going to shift more to the secondary windows, just like they shift from primary to secondary spots.
Right.
And if this gives you a leg up on that, that's valuable to me anyway, as somebody who fishes in a high pressure environment.
Yeah, you know, and it's one of those deals where, hold on, I'll pull up the email here. So what's into this section on Steve's Musky Power Hour? It's got to have a snazzy name. It can't be Effective Musky Theory. Like, that's for nerds.
That might scare people, right?
No, got to keep it Monster Truck, Grave Digger. So looking at. So there's a solar score, which is the sun's altitude, right? Okay? So we're looking for that golden sun angle. You have moon brightness, moon phase, basically not as your majors and minors, but more as a, where are we at in the moon phase of overnight brightness? How might that affect things, right? These are all weighted differently. We have a cloud score, right? Which is how much cloud cover is there. A precipitation score, which is low or no precipitation, right? But also, too, what I think is interesting with these bite windows, this model or this algorithm avoids heavy rainfall as well, right? Because I've seen numerous times where you're not going to get a bite when it's pouring, right? And there's a lot of, we could go down a rabbit hole on that. Obviously, mm-hmm. barometric pressure trends, and it's looking at what trends are hour to hour, in relation with like a big 6 hour thing, wind shift. Now the wind shift is played at like a 3 hour interval. And that's about enough. That's my rough estimation right now of, okay, if we have a wind change, that is enough to start shifting things a little bit. Right. And then you have proximity, which is storm proximity. Do we have precipitation high? Do we have high clouds, falling pressure? And what is the approximate distance from your fishing location to a weather change or a large change, right? Then wind band, because it's one of these things like, you know, howling wind is rarely good. So we have wind broken down into different categories where too much wind will have a negative effect. The right wind, and when I say right wind, I'm saying, you know, anything in that is high teens, you can do it. Past that, things get kind of clunky and you actually notice bait starts getting a little scattered, without going too deep on it. Temperature trending. And then again, those leading edges, so you have edge fronts, post fronts. So it's taking in all your considerations of pretty much everything that you want to look at from a patterning standpoint to understand a day's activity on the water.
Right? You guys think you have, you've put together the necessary components for this. You're fine tuning it at this stage, right? And making this thing to make it operational. This is very good. This is I like that first time hearing about it.
Yeah, it's I crapped her out this week and Bob and me are to pitching around and before we go on, because I know Bob's going to add to that. One thing I want to say with this, when I say this is a beta test, right? There's still work to be done. Right, it's not perfect. No, the moon phase is not perfect. This is to help understand these other bite windows. I have had pretty dang good success. You know, there's, and I called Bob the first time that I had really played with it live in the field, right? It called a bite window at kind of that dreaded time. It was like, what did I say? It was like 2:30 to 3:30. Yep. 2:35 to 3:35. I went, okay, let's see. I looked at it before I launched. It was kind of out of my mind at that point because I've got, you know, those are my monkeys and it is my circus with those kind of clients that day, right? I'm more buried in picking out birds' nests than I am thinking about fricking this stuff. And I kind of noticed, I saw one shoot off the bottom. Like I saw that lightning bolt. If you have live imaging or if you've seen one just rocket up on your down scan, it rockets up. And I realized, I went, holy crap. And we started moving fish in that period, actually caught one that first time out. And I've actually seen, and again, not enough sample size, right? It's so you don't have enough data to hang my hat on it, but I'm going, okay, when that light angle changes and all those factors are at play, it's game on. And I think there's a lot of times where we're just outside of, how do I put it? We're just trudging through or outside of those windows and we're not really paying enough attention, right? I don't know, Bob, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you and I have discussed this for a couple of years, that idea that we're calling it the glass ceiling or something mm-hmm, like yeah. that. Like when you get to that point where like you can watch fish as they come in and they engage your bait, but they don't come above 10 feet. They're not going to come mm-hmm. shallower than 10 feet under the surface.
Right.
And that's great to be fishing through those conditions because you can at least locate where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But then it seems like there's extremely short windows where, they'll come all the way to the boat. Mm-hmm. And we have found it extremely difficult. I know I've found it extremely difficult to get fish to actually come in, say, to the figure eight. They, as soon as the bait gives above 10 feet or whatever, they're like, and they slowly sink down to the bottom and they may watch your bait from below the boat, but they're mm-hmm. not coming. They're not going to move. And it seems like there's this, you know, we've been hypothesizing for a long time about what the situation is. And it's like, well, things we came up with, it's got to do with light penetration.
Mm-hmm.
And these, and if we can come up with, you know, if you can come up with the right recipe of those factors, those weather factors and those other environmental factors that give rise to, yep, and the glass ceiling is broken now, mm-hmm, for an hour.
Yeah.
Go back on those fish that have been looking at you but haven't been moving, and how, let's see if the window is open. And I think that's what you were doing earlier here in the testing of this,
yeah,
is finding that happened. You went back on fish that appeared to be, you know, not willing to come to the boat, and then they were.
Mm-hmm. That's something that happens. It's not a winter thing. It's like an all year long thing. There's that cutoff. Okay. And now I've said it, and I actually told Bob the other day, and I've always said, you know, I'm the guy, most likely I'm the guy that's going to miss the burning of a bait bite, right? Mm-hmm. If the bite is going crazy, right, and it's burning something, or it's I am always fishing negative and neutral in mind, right? I'll reassess at certain times, do this, doing that. But you'll see it if you're expecting those fish will only come so high. Your retrieves are dialed in for that, right? Where I saw in the last outing on this, I went, okay, conditions. I mean, I'm just flat out, folks. Conditions did not look like right for this at all. It was not correct. It was not juicy looking musky weather. And I've got freaking a 47 coming in like a Mack truck in high bright sun, gin clear. Like its hair's on fire. I'd moved the same fish, I'm pretty sure, an hour and a half before, and it wouldn't even come 12 feet from the boat. It just kind of hit that ceiling and just went, meh. Right? So, you know, is it right? Is it wrong? And that's the problem. You don't have enough of a sample size to hang your hat on. And it would be remiss. I mean, I could sit here and tell you, this works every time. Ah! No, right? For $19.99 a week, you can use Steve's Power Hour. Nah. But in the beta testing phase, and Bob and I talked about, if you use this and you're on the water and you catch a fish during that, or you see a change in behavior, write an email to the app, right? I don't need a dissertation. Me and Uncle Bobby, we started out at Hardee's, and then don't tell me all that shit. Don't care. But if you want to drop a note and said, hey, we were moving them and they were slow, and then it happened to line up, and make sure you say where you're at, right? Hey, we're in frickin' North Dakota, and we noticed it on our weekend trip. That would be appreciated. Also, too, if you go out, and maybe more important is if you go out and it's not clicking where you're at, right? Well, I never see anything, right? And the honest truth in that, me and Bob talked about the other day, which is, you know, we have to wait some of this stuff, and it just is what it is. You get an email from somebody. I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, some dude's third musky trip in his life and he can't even figure eight. So, but those, the experiences, if you have any, you know, write them into the app. Cause like I said, it can help influence kind of what's going on here. But, you know, it's another, what I look at this is another tool to take all those factors. Cause that whole list of 10 things that I'm scoring this on are all things that are derivative of known bite windows, right? And each day is so individualistic where if those things aren't going to happen, so let's say there's light angle, like we're talking about that glass ceiling and all these things, that influences change and weighting changes every single day. So you can at least dial in on that stuff. I mean, from a usery standpoint, one thing I will say on this is when you open it, it's loading like your next 24-hour block, right? I'm looking right now where today it said, you know, 4:30 to 5:30, you know, and these windows have already passed. You're not going to get, like, if you just keep updating it all day long, it's not going to give you new ones. It's like, it is what it is, right? So you get a morning window and an afternoon window, right? They might overlap with sunrise and sunset. They might overlap with solar lunar stuff, but that's just kind of the take right now. So you kind of get those two windows. per day outline there, and at the bottom of that there's a little bit more of a explanation. And again, it gives you tomorrow's estimates too. If you look under the two big cells there, it'll give you the estimates for the next day, which we'll update the next once we get past midnight, right? And then you get further into the day, they will update, but it'll kind of lock them in for an AM and a PM by about the morning time there. What else, Bob? What would you say about this? I mean, how we keep it measured or keep it from being skewed, and what's your
thoughts? Yeah, I mean, the thing is, as the model gets tweaked, and basically it's a recipe, right? It's like it's a dash of this, it's a tablespoon of that. I mean, that's kind of the way.
And
to
a
think
lot
about
of
it.
Love.
Right, and tons of love, of course. Tons love of has love. That goes without saying.
Oh, okay, my
but
bad.
Right, but the key, though, I think, to recognize is that the model is going to be tweaked, and there's the potential that, like, folks that contribute something, you know, shoot an email to the app or something like that, you may help us dial it in a little bit better and a little bit faster and stuff like that. That'd be super appreciated if you could add a little bit of, like, oh, that didn't work, or it really worked, or, you know, stuff like that. That would be super valuable to try to figure out what's the most important factors that go in there so that it gets dialed in a little bit more precisely.
Absolutely. So we'll give her a look, kids. A lot of, like I said, goodness gracious, I didn't mean to prattle on that long about, but when it comes to a app that's free, those are some pretty heavy hitter updates. So still got your Muskie Journal. So, oh, one other thing here. Now, for podcasters, maybe not the best thing for you here. Did add this just for newer anglers. There is a Muskie Lure color generator that will tell you, like, recommendations based on your conditions right then and there. So it's reading all these same factors. A lot of the same factors that went into the algorithm for the Power Hour are going into this. That'll help you understand lighting conditions, right? And so it'll help dial in on that a little bit. So if you're sitting there and you don't understand, hey, what color should I even start with? This is looking at your in-the-moment weather conditions and lighting conditions, and at least gives you a list at the bottom of what will stand out, right? At least this should stand out silhouette-wise and things of that nature. So, wowza! Jay, when's your Power Hour?
Man, the Power Hour is fascinating. I'm digging this thing. I got to check this thing out. As soon as we're off the phone here, Steve.
Absolutely. Anyway, back to what we had him on here for. Dr. Bob did one of the cool articles I've seen here in a while. How muskies hunt. It's direct, it's succinct, it's to the point. Bob, what's going on here? Walk us through it. Tell us a tale.
Well, back in like the early 2000s, there were scientists that really want to know how muskies hunt, and they were specifically interested in the relationship between the muskies' use of their eyesight to hunt and also the use of their lateral line to hunt. So what they ended up doing is they did a baseline study using little baby muskies, little ones, fingerlings, and minnows, and they did a careful study filming how these fish actually hunted. They started with unaltered fish, all the fish could see, and all the fish could use their lateral line. And they filmed these fish, and they noticed kind of how muskies, you know, normally engage in hunting behavior, which I always found fascinating. And then they isolated each of the individual factors. And this is something scientists see that. So that was basically the control. And then they said, hey, you know what? Let's see what happens when we take away their sight. Let's see what happens when we take away their lateral line. What happens when we do both, when we take both of those senses away?
Oh, God. Yeah.
So
how'd that go?
Well, it turns out that muskies that don't have their eyesight and they don't have their lateral line, it turns out they don't hunt, which, but that is a thing too. That's an interesting feature though. Because what they would do is they'd introduce these minnows in there and see how the muskies would react to the minnows. And so the muskies still had the use of their nose, not really their nose, but you know, they still had olfactory senses. They could smell. and they still had their ears, essentially. But they didn't have their lateral line, and they didn't have their eyes to use, and they didn't hunt at all. Even if the minnow came within millimeters of their snoot, they would not grab it.
Isn't there a Metallica song called One written about those fish?
I think that's probably true. That's right. I can play it well.
I can play it well. I cannot see. I cannot feel.
Exactly.
God.
But I thought one of the more interesting factors, though, was to look at the baseline. Like, how do muskies actually hunt? And like when they have the use of both of those senses. And it's fascinating. And I don't think it's necessarily going to be a super surprise to people, but they basically, a muskie's hunt consists of two phases. The first phase is they notice their prey item, and that happens at a particular range, and then they slowly stalk up close to it. And then once they get close enough to it, they'll lunge at it very, very quickly. And the way that a fish will typically do that slow stalk is not with their big tail fin. They'll use that, but they're being stealthy typically, which means they sort of scull with their, you know, with their pectoral fins and stuff like that. So they'll kind of slowly stalk them, and then they'll explode into the, and grab it from a short range. So, but they also noticed, they characterized all of these strikes. So they did it for like 166 or something like that, minnows. They tracked them. And the thing that I found super interesting is where the muskies noticed their prey at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if the prey was beyond about 1.5 or 2 body lengths away from the fish, and these are little fish, so they're much smaller fish. They're not adults, so that's why I go with body lengths.
Right.
But if they're further than about 2 body lengths away, basically it's like not interested. But once they get close enough, about 2 body lengths away, they perk up. And they look at it, and they begin their slow stalk behavior. Mm. And about half a body length away, that's where they launch their, like a missile, and grab those things. From about half a body length away, mm-hmm, is where they do their strike with the big old tail fin and, you know, coil up into a C or an S shape and grab it,
mm-hmm,
violently.
And so, now, yep. Do you, just a question on that front, didn't that, with the body length, what was the size of the forage they were feeding on?
The size of the forage was, it was a fathead minnow.
Okay.
So that's, you know, a couple inches.
Yeah.
Inch and a half, 2 inches.
Definitely a proximity thing going on there with that result.
Yeah.
You don't say. Mm. Shocking. Yeah, shocking. He wouldn't.
But it's fascinating because it took place in an aquarium, right? I mean, it was crystal clear water. Mm-hmm. They could have seen these fathead minnows from 20 feet away,
mm-hmm,
50 feet away. They probably could have seen them. I mean, it was crystal clear water, and still there's 2 body lengths. So I kind of think like they go, if it's further than 2.5 or 2 body lengths away, if I do my slow stalk, they're going to see me.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have time to react.
Right.
And it's not going to be a successful capture. So it's like it's not that they don't notice it, I would guess. It's that they're like, it's outside of my range.
Yeah. It's
I could get there, but yeah.
Right. I could, but I don't want to. Yeah.
Right.
Which is, you know, Bob and I, we've discussed, and in the forthcoming book, I'm working on kind of categorizing or canonizing some, without going too deep on it, kind of zones around a muskie, right? And I mean, inevitably, there's a certain distance where they cannot perceive, right? Everything has that outer edge, but, you know, it makes you shake your head sometimes where you go, you know, why is it every now and again one will just launch off where, you know, the majority of the time that proximity matters so much, which heck, it goes back to what we were talking about with the power hour, trying to dial that in of like,
yeah,
you know, there's the vast majority of the time, it's got to be 2 body lengths.
Yeah.
And it, That's fascinating. What else did they find here?
Other interesting things they found was, and this, some of the stuff goes against what traditional thinking is on muskie hunting behavior, and some of it lines up perfect. So one of the things that they also measured in every one of the of these strike events is that the prey, when it was first noticed, like, and you could see it, like they had them on film, you could see like, oh, the muskie, it's one of those things, and you've probably even seen it if you've ever sight fished for these things. They kind of perk up when they see it. Like, it's almost like you could see their, it's like if they were a dog, their ears would come up like, ooh, there's something. And so they could see that. And what direction does the prey item have to be from the muskie's straight ahead direction? Because that's the only way the fish can really move. They can only move straight ahead. They don't move backwards worth a crap.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they're propelled by their big tail fin. Mm-hmm. They're going to go forward. They can turn, but they got to go forward. But so the angle that they had, if you look right or left, it's 45 degrees to the right, 45 degrees to the left. Most of the strikes came in, not strikes, but most of them were noticed being within that right or left 45 degrees. So it's like a 90 degree spread centered on straight ahead.
Like a cone of killing.
So not too far to the right, not too far to the left. Although there were a couple of ones where they noticed them and the prey item was almost directly behind them. There's a couple of those, but most of them, I would say probably 70 or 80% of the noticed prey items were within that 90 degree sweep right or left centered on the middle, 45 on either side. So that's probably not super surprising. What I found surprising is the up down angles that they would perceive and start to notice the prey items. That was about 60 degrees up and down. And it was uniform, meaning there's just as many stalks began when the prey was 60 degrees below them as there were the beginning of a stalking behavior 60 degrees above them.
Interesting.
Now, we've all heard, muskies feed up.
Yeah.
But the ones in the controlled environment didn't. they didn't care if it was up or down. They could see under their chin.
Well, that you say that, and it makes you almost question, because that's dogma. I love anything that challenges dogma, right?
Yeah.
And that makes you think, why... I've questioned it. I think we all have. Why would there be muskie suspended in the open basin 2 feet down or out there, with their backs in the sun?
Right.
Well, if they can feed at that, what does it matter?
Right.
That's an interesting takeaway for sure. And so that was 60 degrees up, 60 degrees down, which is that's pretty spread.
Right.
But
almost no strikes happened above or below 60 degrees. But no stalking events began when the prey event was noticed above 60 or below negative 60, 60 degrees below. So don't cast it right over their back and expect them to hit it.
Right.
They won't notice that.
Right.
Because that 90 degrees, an angle of 90 degrees from straight ahead would be straight up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that's kind of, if they're, you look at it and you go, we know they'll eat off the bottom, right? We know they'll eat off the top. And it's just like, okay, that makes more sense where, the thought process has been for so long, the suspendos are, they are expecting to feed forward and up. Therefore, your trolling bait must run at X, Y, and Z. The forage. Now it's wondering, I you say that and it's just something I've looked at where a couple times I've had pretty dramatic trolling strikes. You end up with no hooks in the fish and you got scratches all over the top of the bait. Is it possible for them to feed downward? Like say a headluck's coming 7 feet down and he's up at 3 and he just goes straight down at the thing.
Right.
That's on the table now, eh? Great.
Well, it just means you got to, I mean, it would just mean that you got to put your baits where you think they're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, where you think they're going to actually be. You don't have to guess, well, I want to put it below, you know, I want to make sure that it's above them or something like that. If you just put them where you think they're going to be, then you're in the window, right?
Right.
60 degrees up and 60 degrees down. So it'll be about expectations then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of in a safer. So now with that controlled environment, well, obviously with the study, you know, is there any kind of cover in there, or is it all open?
It's all open, completely open aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, and this is something, I mean, I've listened to a bunch of folks talking about it. You've talked about it. I know Herbie's talked about it. Is the fish that are in cover, they probably don't generally engage in the stock. If they're in ambush position,
right,
if something comes close enough, they're exploding on it. They're probably striking without stocking.
Right. But they're staged.
They're not
in
chasing.
One of those. I hate the term reaction strike, but I mean, he's on. You know, here he is, dug into the weeds, ready to rock and roll. That thing goes lateral. He comes out, flicks the tail a couple of times, whackety schmackety. You're right.
Right.
You know, but.
Well, we always talk about muskies only want to expend X amount of energy. You know what I mean? We've always talked about that and always thought that, you know, and it, I mean, that, I think the study, the conclusion wise for that with the proximity thing is these fish got to know that their percentage of success has got to be really close. They'll expend that amount of energy because it's innate within them that they're going to be successful killing it. If it's 2-3 feet out, it's just like they got to expend more energy, and mm-hmm. you know, the ratio of success is probably less in their mind. They just know that.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I don't know.
No, it's caloric.
These are babies, right? These are babies, right? These are fingerling fish. These are not adults.
They don't have experience yet. Right.
There's no experience. So they don't know. I mean, they also, I mean, there aren't very many mirrors in the muskie's environment. They don't know how big they are either.
Right. That rule. Well, and it's interesting. Bob and I were talking the other night where there's another study. It was a food study. You're talking about here suckers. People are fishing suckers in a lake where there's zero suckers, but they love suckers, right?
Oh, yep. Absolutely. Yep.
There you go. Yeah.
Which is.
So.
That's like me taking a taco to frickin' Africa. What's this? I don't know.
Right.
Do we eat it or is this what is this? Right.
Right.
But I think it's probably genetically ingrained. You know, that's half our problem is we have too much cognizant thought where a muskie goes, this is how I live, this is what I do, therefore.
Right.
And he doesn't, there's not even an inner monologue articulating that. It's just, these are my rules.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
It's interesting, too, you mentioned that, the idea of the reaction strike. There's something to study on that, too, which is fantastic stuff. But the study showed that there were a small number of strikes that took. So this, now we get to strike behavior instead of stalk behavior.
Yeah.
So what do they do when they strike? Okay. At about a half body length away, they curl up their body and explode and grab the prey item.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time that happened they were in a very narrow set of angles. Like it was, you were within like 10 degrees on either side. So the fish goes towards the prey item and the prey item is straight ahead of them when they hit it. And they strike from quite close, very close. They do that activity. Mm-hmm. But there was one class of situation. It wasn't a lot of strikes that happened this way, but it was a few, and it was measurable enough. And scientists, when they see stuff that are what we call them outliers, and everybody probably knows what an outlier is. It's like unexpected.
Jay.
There were a few. Jay's an outlier in many ways.
Bingo.
Most of the, in, you know, and. Lot all the good ways.
All the good ways.
But the outlier was that there were a few strikes that took place from much further away than was typical. So I had the average, which was about a half body length, but there were a few that were like really far away. In every one of those cases, instead of the prey item being within like 10 degrees on either side, the prey items were always more than 20 degrees away from the muskie's forward direction. So in other words, it was out of, you know, quite far away from straight ahead. And in almost all of the cases, those prey items were also moving, because they had this, it's all videoed, mm-hmm. The prey items were also moving so as to increase that angle. Hmm. So in other words, those prey items were in the non-optimal position for the muskie to strike, and they were, and it was, the situation was getting worse as judged by the muskie. So that's a desperation strike. It's like, oh, the jig is up. It spotted me. It's getting away from me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to snap at it.
Right. I'm going to, yeah, why not? Or
right.
Close the gap. Yeah.
I've started my stock. The jig is up, but I might as well take a snap at it and hopefully I'll get it. I've already spent this energy. I might as well, you know, take a shot at it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a situation where I'm thinking to myself, okay, let's say you got a fish. It's coming in slow and lazy. It doesn't look like it's going to hit in the figure eight. And you very rapidly change direction and take it well away from the fish's forward direction.
Yes. Yeah.
And when you do that, you might just get them to snap at it out of desperation.
Right.
And I think we all know that we all try to do that. That's what the figure eight is intended to do, right?
But, right. Which is, it's funny where that strike behavior, the more confident and the more comfortable you get in the figure eight, the more, I call it, can play and keep away.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because I watch people, if you're early on in your muskie game, you're trying to get him to eat it. Please, I'm trying to keep it away from him.
Right, yeah.
Right, you can't force feed him. You've got to make him do the thing, which is like you said. It's funny you said that, the desperation strike where, I don't know if this is the same mannerism, the same reaction, but I'll see these ones where they're just like, kind of like, it's like a half lunge. It's like, bah! And they just kind of just... kind of not even spring at it, but they just kind of grab it, and you always kind of got them hooked in a weird, not in a weird, like, yep. It's in the corner of the mouth. It's like the back hook, corner of the mouth, figure eight fish. You're like, what?
You know? They just slapped at it, kind of. Yeah.
That's interesting. So, well, if we get muskies to sit still enough to get the protractor out.
Exactly.
Can we,
I guess that's why you film them.
Can we get an overlay? Hold on, let me start coding so I can get a protractor overlay on live scope. Hold on, my bait is knotted. Ah, there it is. It's 19 degrees.
Oh, do
that. Make it 20.
Oh, there he went. Yeah, let's complicate it some more.
Right.
What would you say?
Basically, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you got a fish that's coming in, your bait's right in front of them, and they look lazy, try to move it more than 20 degrees away from them. Mm-hmm. Like, try to get it out of their field of view by 20 degrees.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter. It could be up, down, side, you know, side to side. Try to take it away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they might lose sight of it, and that might screw it up.
Right.
The risk. But if they're lazy anyway, now, who's doing desperation at this point? It's probably you. If you see a fish coming in lazy, and you're like, this one might go around like half a turn and give up, mm-hmm. If it looks like that. But if you try to move it away from it, maybe you'll get them to take a snap at it, and I would say that is a reaction strike.
Oh, one of my favorite moves is not even figure eight, and it's just walking around the trolling motor real hard.
Yeah, there's a thing.
And
yeah.
I mean, it's, if you've not done that, that's I shouldn't even tell people that one. That's one of my favorite. I just said that out loud like I was just talking to Bob in the driveway. Yeah. Anyway, so just walking around a hard corner once and see what happens to right. you.
Yep. That hard corner might be the bow. So.
Yeah. Might be the bow. Yeah. Could be anything. But yeah, that thing, you go, that's not how you figure eight. It's like, if I got a big one coming in, I know it's big, I generally do that. And I'll just switch to the other side. You know, I'm always a port side guy, but I would just like walk them around the motor once and then a big loop back around. And it's pretty nasty because I'll come in, get that straightaway, turn the bait, come around, round the trolling motor, and then kind of loop back around. And that usually does it. That's the figure. What that? I don't even know what that is. That's like a freaking
figure beta.
That's the frick. It looks like a Western Ranch brand in my mind. Well, what else? Anything else of relevance here for kids to read up?
I mean, that's the basis, right? Now that you can start doing stuff like, well, what if they can't see? What if they can't feel? And that got interesting too. If they can't see, they don't stalk.
I cannot see. I'm going to say.
So if they can't see, they don't stalk. They'll snap at something that comes close, but they won't stalk something if they don't see it. They engaged in no stalking behavior. And that kind of flies in the face of folks that say, well, they have to feel it from, they can feel it at a greater distance and then they'll come look at it. It doesn't, at least in this study with these young muskies, it appeared that they don't use their lateral line to locate things that are far away. Mm-hmm. The lateral line appears to be used, and this is what they really wanted to study. The lateral line gives them really precise location information when the prey item is close to their body, which allows them to precisely know where the thing is, even if they can't see it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it allows them to strike from about half a body length away and be quite confident in hitting it, even if they can't see. Now, if they couldn't see the strike, they could still hit things that came close. So minnows that wandered close to these muskies, they'd snap at them. Mm-hmm. And they got them. They nailed them just as effectively as if they had eyes.
Mm.
But they would never stalk them. They would never, there's the thing, 6 feet away from me. I'm going to swim up and have a look at it and then lunge at it. They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't stalk it. They had to wait until the something, their prey item, got close. And then they would do it. They would strike. And they would hit it almost, basically just as well, just as effective as those that had sight.
Well, what's the applicational takeaway there? What's your thoughts on that?
That sight is really important for getting your baits noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So vibration is important for getting your baits struck and actually hooked up.
Yeah.
So the louder something is, the easier it is for them to detect where it is, and the better, when they're at close proximity. So if you're looking to get to attract a fish, let them see it.
Yeah.
A vibration, I don't think, is going to help all that much.
Which is, it's funny because I think about so much where I'm always like, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down, pounding on it for years with people, or getting down to where the fish are, which this just reiterates the pounding of proximity the distance they're willing to move and the distance it takes to get them to engage, you kind of go, how many fish are you blowing past?
Right. Very true.
And then how many fish we go back to light angle, could they even see it? Could they even perceive it? Because I mean, something I've been mulling over a lot again is that range of perception. And then how much, for lack of a better term, signal, right? How much signal does it take for it to be vibrational only?
Right.
So this is saying, well, that's a minor point. The vibration helps to triangulate, right, where the target is. But visually, the profile, because we know they can't see, it's color. They're not like sitting here dissecting Rembrandts, you know, it's profile
right.
and visual representation is far more important. Where do you go? How often is it that you're a foot off? Right.
And that foot is everything. That's the difference everything. Between that. Yeah, exactly.
Which is, you know, you've got it's interesting because you said the 60 degrees up or down, but you have, lack of a better term, a hip box, right? You've got that proximity. And in my opinion, that widens at different times, right? When you look at when everybody's getting in, they're all connecting with fish, right?
Yeah.
I see that in the summer, in peak water temperatures, when muskies are shallow during sunrise and sunset.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Structurally, they're slunking back out. This just goes back to it. If your bait's not close to him, guess what's not going to happen? Period. You can throw that again. It's back to just pure binary, pure simplistic. Throw that topwater all day long from the sun up to sundown and tell me how many times a day it works.
Yeah.
Right? Where you could start off with the topwater. By the middle of the day, you're throwing a pounder and you rotate back through because there's a cycle. And I mean, it reideates because theoretically, if let's say that twofold here, we're talking about how they can perceive and how they strike and how they hunt. If a muskie is in shallow water in the middle of the day, peak summer conditions, you're throwing a bucktail. If he was there and you landed close enough, it pretty much sounds like he's going to see, feel, perceive that bait and is most likely to react in some capacity, right? If it's actively feeding. But it's kind of like twofold. It's like every answer answers another question, which is, well, proximity is a moving target all day long. And I see it in my fishing. I know you do too, Bob, where it's like, I don't worry about moving muskies anymore. Does that make it? And I'm not trying to sound verbose, but I'm going to move them. I'm going to see them because I'm kind of ebbing and flowing in and out of structure and like, okay, this time of day, this is what should be going on and all this stuff. But it's funny, like you're saying, where like, you know, it's to me what muskies have a decision. They can make a choice, right? We've seen that a million times, whether they're going to do it or not. But I believe a lot of times that you can coax the vast majority of fish that we call negative or neutral into engagement, at least checking it out. And my mind's been changing on that, especially with live imaging and what I've learned and what I've seen from experiences. Like, there's some of them, they just won't move at all. But I think a lot of them, if you get close enough, they're going to check it out. You know, and I don't believe in quote unquote curious follows because of caloric risk, caloric reward. But you might have a bait that's far too large. It's not seasonally appropriate. It's not forage based appropriate. But he'll check it out just because that's kind of their job. I mean, am I making any sense here? What's the thought?
No, I mean, I think so. I mean, if you see if they perceive a large enough prey item, I mean, it is their job. That is what they are there to do, is to predate. They're there to feed. And I mean, even if it doesn't look like something that they're used to seeing, like a 14 inch sucker in a lake that doesn't have suckers.
Right.
Dang it. They better check it out. I mean, really, you're going to give up a chance at a monster meal and really you're going to give that chance up just because, well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the only case where you won't see that happen, where they probably won't check it out, is when those those large prey items that they occasionally check out have stung them in the mouth, and then they have an out of water experience, and then they're probably going to be a little bit more reticent about
that. They remembered that one, yeah.
Right. So, but I mean, I think unpressured fish are certainly gonna, it's their job to check those things out and to patrol and to find those new prey items that they haven't experienced before. And I think you're gonna move them.
Well, and it's one of those things of it, you know, we're pounding on all the time, which is proximity, but you know, the proximity of a lure reduces the caloric risk.
Yeah.
And that's why I say anymore, I'm not worried about moving them. It's very, I mean, it's exceptionally rare for me at this stage yeah. in the game where it's like nothing's happening. Been there. It happens. I'm sure I say that'll happen tomorrow. But, you know, it's one of those things where, okay, structure will lead you to them. Presenting properly and considering that, because in my mind right now, there's always different patterns. But man, these things are, if you're adhering to structure, they're touching something, right? Which makes it a pretty easy target. He's on the, if you're fishing a point, you might as well run something that's going 2 feet over the point, because he's going to be touching it most of the time, right? They're going to mm-hmm. be belly on that. And, you know, it increases, I mean, it's just about increasing how many contacts you have, because I guess you look at it and you go, well, the inevitability, if I have enough contacts, one of them will eat. Right?
Right.
That, which is hand in glove, where it's like I'm listening to what you're having to say and the takeaways from that study, which is like, okay, well, you know, it didn't seem, it translates on the water where you hear, I said it earlier, we were talking about the thing, you see one rocket ship up, or we've all had that bite where that one just comes streaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they'll do yep. it, but they don't do it that often.
Right.
And yep. And it's you said outliers. It's like one of those things. It's really, really hard to put together a consistent pattern on outliers.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last thing that they talked about too on there was, well, what if you take their lateral lines away and they only have their eyes? This is interesting too, because it show they were trying to figure out, well, how important is the lateral line to these fish?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it's relatively important to these fish, because they carefully measured the distance that they would make a strike from. And when the fish lost lateral lines, the ability to use their lateral, but they still had their eyes, they would close to a closer distance before they launched the strike. They would go to like 0.2 or body lengths or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is, I mean, now we're making inferences to why that happened, but right. The likely reason is that without the lateral line information they were getting on location of the prey item, they felt as though in order to be successful, they needed to be able to be closer in order to get a successful strike.
Mm-hmm.
That's the inference anyway. So, yeah, the lateral line is what allows them to strike from further away. I mean, it's still relatively close, but if without their lateral lines, they're gonna strike from even closer than normal. It's yeah, so valuable.
Yeah, I mean, and that's when I may have even told you I did have a blind one time on a lake I fish all the time that had no eyeballs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could catch him winter, spring, summer, or fall, folks. It didn't matter. He lived on one tree. Son of a bitch never left it. And it was like, if I was in desperation mode, I called him Blind Larry. I got pictures to prove it, too.
Blind
folks.
Larry.
Not an eyeball in his head.
Was it a healthy, relatively healthy fish?
It's like
too,
a 43. Or? It was just always a 43. It wasn't the fattest. I mean, it wasn't like emaciated, okay. But it lived on okay. one tree, by God. It would be like snowing. He's there. 75. It didn't matter. So we don't know how far they'll travel without eyes, but it didn't, from my experience, it didn't seem very far. But,
yeah.
You know, it's funny that fish, like if you could get it right against, it was a piece of standing timber. If you could get a crankbait to run like and hit it, like they'll bang off a piece of timber. It was like, here it comes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many experiences in the wild any of us will have with a fish with no lateral line. But
yeah, that's probably hard. But
probably hard.
So. Well, they generally don't swim in the cobalt solution that they use to sting their lateral lines out of them. So
probably
that would be
not having a great yeah. day. Horrible. Well, Bob. It's always ridiculously interesting, and he goes on for quite a bit and some really in depth stuff there. So that article's on the. On the Aparuski there, if you want to check that out, if you're a reader, if you know how to read, there's how many, wonder what the percentage of musky anglers that can read is. probably not real high.
I would say.
Man.
I think it's super high.
Mid-30s? Mid-30%?
At least.
Great concept for your next study, Bob.
That's the next one. Yep. Okay.
We need a sample group, though.
Sample group, but yeah. I'll send them a letter.
if you get a response.
If I don't get a response, I know exactly what it is.
Hey, darling, they're trying to buy our house again. It's a letter for Dr. Bob. He had no clue. So that's too good, man. Well, anyway, Bob's cranking out more hits for the app there, and we got tons of funds of good content out there for you. But man, always good having you, Bob. It's you know, fun.
Appreciate the opportunity, man.
Oh yeah,
as always.
Well, what a honor. what a great opportunity. Put it right now. You can hear him typing. He's putting it on his LinkedIn.
It's on my CV.
Podcast guest. Anyway, well, guys, Jay Bird, say goodnight. We're going to wrap it up here, guys. Check out the updates on the app. Check out Bob's article, and we'll catch up on Q&A next week. Say goodnight, Bob.
Definitely, Bob. Thanks, man. Yep. Thanks, everybody.
Yep, thanks.